The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
Remember 2016, the Berlin Christmas market attack where ISIS claimed responsibility and they took a truck and they drove it into a busy crowd at Christmas time. The man, it turned out, was a Tunisian illegal immigrant who was able to elude police for months as he traversed Europe and incited riots at migrant holding centers. He killed 12 people that day, injured 56. After his bloody murder streak, he was able to make it to Italy before the police there shot him. So the jihadist is dead, but his legacy apparently lives on. On Sunday, a few of his friends led a failed attack on a half marathon in Berlin. Now, this is really important. There was a shooting that happened in Berlin the day before, and it was a mass shooting. Wait a minute. I thought it was hard to get guns in. Oh, pay no attention. The police came out and said, look, this is a white guy. People were trying to, you know, make it into a nationalist kind of Nazi thing. And the police immediately came out and said, no, this guy was seriously disturbed. He had mental health disorders. What a surprise. But then the next day, police buckled down and were watching an event that they were, I'm quoting the police, isolated indications that those arrested aged between 19 and 21 years old were participating in the preparation of a crime in connection with this big event. So the terrorists were deciding that they were going to go in and kill a bunch of people, and they were caught at the last minute. They were planning on using knives for the foiled attack. When asked about the suspects, police spokesman said that they were very vague indications, but because of the high threat level, we immediately started with our police searches and arrests. But at the moment, there are really no concrete indications that an attack on the Berlin half marathon was foreseen. Thankfully, the plot was foiled and no one was injured or killed. Knives. Oh, that reminds me. London is talking now about banning knives. Of course, the four people who died and the 30 who were injured in Munster, Germany on Saturday, mowed down by a car that hit that crowd of people, they were not so lucky, but I'll take the good over the bad.
It's Monday, April 9th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So I don't know if you saw the hero of the Parkland shooting got out of the hospital and what he said. We'll go over that here in a few minutes. He was very, very clear that everybody is letting the victims in the school and, you know, future victims down because they're not actually taking any concrete steps. And he spoke about the sheriff's department and this promise where they weren't going to prosecute anybody who you know, broke the law at school. We'll talk about that. But I wanted to get David Hogg on with us. Now, David Hogg is obviously a very controversial figure and has stirred up an awful lot of passion on both sides. But that's not the David Hogg we're talking to. This is the David Hogg that is receiving death threats and his parents are being threatened and he is constantly being mistaken for the other David Hogg. And he wrote a powerful, powerful op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week where he says, I support gun rights and I'm David Hogg. Welcome to the program, David. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. So tell me your story of, you know, when this broke and David Hogg started being as vocal as he was, what started to happen to your life?
Well, it was kind of an awful time for that to happen because I was doing a lot of things in my life at the time. I was getting my learner's permit. I was applying for a checking account. I was getting a job. I go to college, so I'm here to learn. I'm not here to have people ask me about questions all the time about the news. But it was just people constantly like, oh, are you the David Hogg in Florida? And at first it wasn't a lot of people, but then as he kept getting on the air and more people had a chance of seeing him, then it became more of a everyday thing, and people were responding to all our pictures, like not just my pictures, but my family's pictures on social media, asking questions, making comments, rude comments, and things like that that they wouldn't actually say in person.
So I get this, all the time people say, oh, you the Leonardo DiCaprio from the movies. And I'll say, no, I just look a lot like him. I mean, that happens a lot of the time, and you can't do anything about mistaken identity. However, this turned into trouble for you and your family.
Yeah, so I actually went off social media for a time. I came back, but people were taking our photos offline and editing them and, like, putting hog noses on them, which wasn't a big deal, but putting, like, anti-Semitic things, and my family's not Jewish. We have nothing against Jewish people, but that's just rude for anybody to have to see. People were stopping my little brother, because I used to go to school at my little brother's school, and asking if the David Hogg in the news was his older brother, which didn't make a whole lot of sense either, because why would I be in Florida and he would be in Charlotte?
So you wrote this op-ed to the Wall Street Journal. How did that come about? And then I want to talk to you a little bit about it.
They actually responded to me on Twitter after I posted a few things on Twitter, and asked me to write it, and I did.
Well, it's really well written, and in it you talk about that you are not for gun control. You're the opposite of the other David Hogg, and you said there are other things that we should be doing. You want to share some of that?
Yeah, I feel like more of the issue is education. I think that gun education should almost be like CPR education. So like in your health class or some other class, you should have to learn about what to do in a situation when you see a gun, or when somebody approaches you with a gun, or things like that. So people just know more. And then when you're procuring a gun, maybe more background checks, but that's, the main issue is just education and knowing how to use one, knowing what to do if you see one. And then like, even like little children, like elementary school kids, like knowing not to play with that, knowing that that's not a Nerf gun and you can't point that at somebody else.
Do you have guns in your home?
Yes. My father has guns.
And so do you go shooting with him, or are they for security, or are you coming from a gun home?
Yes, I have. My dad has taught me all there is to know, well, all that I need to know about guns at my age, and we don't do as much shooting as maybe we would like, but we don't shoot in the city.
And you guys members of the NRA?
No, we are not.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing that your clothes aren't soaked in blood then. you said, look, I stand for the Second Amendment, but I also stand for the other David Hogg's First Amendment.
Yes.
You want to expand on that a bit?
Well, I stand for everybody's right to free speech, and I feel like the only way we'll ever get anything done in this country is if we acknowledge each other's opinions and change on both sides. Not everyone can always be right, especially with differing views.
You wrote, people who aren't willing to budge from their goal make it harder for change to occur. Some of David Hogg's recent actions, like calling sponsors to stop advertising on a commenter's program because she was rude to him, come across as bullying.
Yes. I don't think I was bullied in my life, and I don't find bullying an acceptable way to have anything done. I feel like that's actually going to, even if your cause is good, that's going to make people not like your cause as much because of how you're representing it and how you're trying to get things accomplished.
You say teenagers are smart, but we certainly don't have all of the answers. I'd like to see him soften his tone and be more respectful in delivering his message.
Yes. Well, we haven't gone through everything. We've been in school our whole lives, but we haven't experienced the real world yet. We haven't experienced the entire realm of politics. He's just now getting into like journalism and everything, and that's fine. But there are plenty of people who know a lot more about what he's trying to do than him, and plenty of people who know a lot more than what I'm trying to do than me.
David, I'm sorry for what your family has gone through, but I'm glad to see. Have you had response from this now?
Yeah, people are like even at my job, people are like, "Oh, are you the David Hogg in the news?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." And they're like, "Oh, I'm so sorry for what you've gone through." And it's real nice to hear people like apologize for actions of other people.
Yeah, good. David, thank you very much. Appreciate it. God bless. You know, he talked about education, shooting education at school. I've got an amazing story and an artifact. I have to go up to the vault and pull it out of the archives. But I got to share a story with you that will blow your mind on how much the world has changed since the progressive era began. Coming up in just a few minutes.
Glenn Beck.
So when it comes to guns and schools, there's a lot of controversy, and there always has been. And this isn't the first time that people have said, like our just last guest just said, you know, I think that we should have, you know, gun training in school. There should be some sort of training that you know, that shows that. You know, gives everybody a basic understanding of what a gun does, gun safety.
It'd be great too, though. It wasn't just scare tactics, right? It's not just about how you react if some dangerous person comes in with a gun, which is important, right? Everyone should have some basic idea. Who was it? Was it Ben Sherwood years ago who wrote the book about surviving critical moments in your life, and how people think like, well, you get into a plane crash, you're just dead. And what you find out is that the numbers are not like that. The numbers are, if you're prepared for how to deal with it, a lot of people actually survive. Same thing with, you remember, this is at the time of that really bad fire at the bar in, I think it was Rhode Island, where so many people couldn't get out. And it's just a matter of knowing the escape routes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's important. But it's also about like taking the stigma away. There's that negative sort of stigma of guns. And I know this from growing up in the Northeast. Like, people just, generally speaking, think of them as bad. And how do you deal with this bad thing? Instead of understanding what it does, how to use it, the good things that can come with it. And that would be a great place for
yeah.
it to go.
It would never, you would never want it in school, because they would find a way to demonize them and make them horrible. Okay, but this isn't the first time. Now, this, what I'm holding is from the Mercury Museum, and I love this. This is from 1906, and this comes from Theodore Roosevelt, and this was a campaign to get gun safety and shooting into our public schools. Now imagine this. Now it's a giant target, and it says, "Who can kill teddy bear?" Okay, that just sounds crazy. Remember, this is at a time where Teddy Bear was just getting its name from Theodore Roosevelt, from Teddy Roosevelt. So it shows a bear, and then it has targets all across the bear. Now, this was made for kids. This was made for kids. Mm. So that's one way that things have changed so much in the last 100 years. But there was an outcry. When this went out, the school, the towns were so outraged that the president of the United States would try to get shooting done in schools. And do you know why? Because the locals said, "How dare the federal government try to tell us what needs to happen in our own local schools. We'll put shooting ranges in if we choose to put shooting ranges." They had no problem at the time with putting shooting ranges into school. What they had the problem with was the federal government trying to tell them what to do when it came to educating their kids.
Wow.
Is that not nuts? Look what the progressive era has done. The progressives, Theodore Roosevelt, he's taking that step because the progressives believe they should have the power to tell you what to do in your own town, in your own home, and in your own life. But 100 years ago, people didn't believe that. People didn't think that way. People knew, wait, I'm free. My town will decide what's best. Get away from us. And if we want guns, we'll do guns. If we don't want guns, we won't do guns. But get away from us, federal government. You have nothing to do. To now, everyone is crying out saying the federal government must do these things. The federal government has the ultimate responsibility in keeping us safe, in telling us what we can and cannot do in school and in our own homes. And when we bring up maybe we should have, you know, shooting classes in school, oh my gosh, that's an outrage. You local yokels, you have no idea what you're doing. You're all dangerous. The government needs to restrict you. It's amazing how 100 years of progressive thought has perverted the idea of what it really means to be free in America.
That's a long journey you just described.
100 years.
I mean, 100 years, and I mean, really, it happened a lot faster than that. But I mean, to be able to go to a place where, it should be local control. They talked about there's a school, I believe it's in Idaho, that has already done the arming the teachers thing.
Mm-hmm.
They've done it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's not really a police station nearby. Yeah. there's not an option.
Yeah.
So they actually have this. They actually have armed teachers. Stunningly, there's been no school shootings at this school. But I mean, that is something that I think a good chunk of the country understands still. Right. There's still a good chunk of the country that understands that, you know, law-abiding gun owners that are properly trained are a real positive influence on the country. But there's huge. We talk about this blue and red sort of divide among the country. That is so real because guns are in large chunks of the country are not treated as if they're anything but murderous devices used by bad people.
So I want to take that to someplace else. I want to take that to what happened, what I read about this weekend in Indiana, where these two guys were tired of the potholes. So they went out and they took their own money and they bought asphalt and they're repairing the potholes. Wait until you hear the reaction. No, it's not what you think.
Glenn Beck, Mercury. Glenn Beck program.
So let me show you how things are changing. Now, I think these guys, I want to talk to these guys in about a week because I have a feeling things are going to change for them now that they're getting a national attention, which I would find really unfortunate. There are two men in Indiana that were really tired of waiting for the city to repair potholes. So they started a grassroots organization called Open Source Roads, and they started to make an Indianapolis pothole map and where the really bad ones are. And then they were tired of sitting around waiting for the city. So Mike Warren and Chris Lang spent their own money, and they're not wealthy, and they bought asphalt. And now they're going around and they're filling the potholes in the city. Now, they're fans of Ron Swanson from Parks and Recreation. One of them's got, he said, I've got a poster on my wall of Ron.
And he's basically a libertarian on the show.
Yeah.
In real life, he does not seem to be at all. The actor that portrays him, but yes.
Right. Okay. So He said that they have gathered about five different friends, these two, and Warren and Lang and sometimes others, they go out on their weekends in their spare time and they fix the worst potholes in the city. We want to fill a lot of potholes. We want people to help out and see that we don't need to rely on this monopoly of a government for it. I want that to be what starts the people taking charge about of their own life and start talking about change. The city is going to fail at their own monopoly. Why should they have that monopoly? The Department of Public Works audit rated the city's roads poor, said it would take $732 million to upgrade them to fair condition. So they don't have a permit for what they're doing.
This is awesome.
I know. But they say the city and the police officers, they're not stopping them. Betsy Whitmore, chief of communications for the Indianapolis Department of Public Works, said in an email that obtaining a permit to work on city-owned streets and right-of-way is important so the city knows what's going on. What kind of answer is that? I mean, I love that answer. But what? That's like a Texan. You just let us know what you're doing in the streets. Can you imagine doing this in New York?
I can't. That's, though, also... seems like a way that they're saying you better get a permit or this is going to stop. No,
I don't know. So far, Lang, one of the guys, estimates they spend between $800 and $1,000 for tools and for asphalt. Part of the money came from their own paychecks and donations for their GoFundMe page. Campaign to fix Maroads, M-U-H, Maroads.
I love these guys.
I know. The two started April 2017 after Warren saw a video of anarchists in Portland patching their city streets.
This is hilarious.
I love this. The anarchists in Oregon say that capitalism and government are not necessary for society to function, according to the Oregonian. Okay, so these guys don't necessarily have a lot in common, except, you know... capitalism, all right, in Oregon doesn't work, but they both believe we don't need the government to do the things that they don't do well. We can do this. Lang and Warren say they are not anarchists and do not want to replace the Department of Public Works, but they thought a similar grassroots repair effort would help solve some of the problems on side streets and call on the city to provide better service.
That's really interesting because, I mean, one of the classic complaints against libertarianism is, what are you, what are you just private businesses to have to run all the roads?
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I mean, we could see how it works when you drive around, let's say, a business.
Mm-hmm.
How many entrances to Walmart are in complete disrepair? They're not, because they want people to drive on those roads and come into the store. So they make sure that they're kept up. If you give private business an incentive... to do these things, and they will be done better. I love this, though. This is a great idea because this, it's interesting. It's not, because there was a story we talked about with Toronto a few months ago where
I hate this story and I simultaneously love this story.
Yeah, because it's the outcome is unfortunate, but Toronto said they needed stairs to go down this little walk, this little hill. I mean, it's a little, not even a hill. It's
like in a park, right?
Right. It was like a, you know, from one level of like parking lot into the park. It was a very short stair. I mean, it was 10 stairs, 12 stairs.
Yeah.
And it was going to be $55,000 to $60,000 for them to install these stairs. Well, a local guy is just like, yeah, what's $55,000? He spent $550 of his own money.
He bought the lumber and the concrete.
Yep. Built the stairs himself, put them in, perfectly fine stairs, and problem solved. Until, of course, Toronto got wind of it and then came in and tore the stairs down because they didn't like the way it was done. Now, of course, you're going to always have those issues.
But the point that I think he was trying to make was it doesn't take $60,000 to make stairs.
Exactly.
It doesn't take that.
We all know it doesn't.
Yes.
I mean, we even hear this with the wall, where they're talking about the wall on the southern border, and they're like, oh, it's going to cost, you know, $25 billion. And you're just like, $25 billion for a wall? Like, I understand that it's government and everything seems to cost more, but Does that sound even remotely coherent?
May I just say this? Listen to what these two guys in Indiana said. They were asked, "Are you worried about getting hit?" While it seems like two people can actually fill potholes, there is a supporting group to protect the workers from traffic. This can include an extra staff to hold warning signs for drivers and a driver of a blocker truck to provide a barrier between pothole filling workers and traffic. Whitmore said, usually the city uses 5 to 6 people. We pretty much get it done with 2.
That's great.
It is.
Because there are, obviously, like if you had just guys kind of coming around and building bridges across things, like you might have some issues. Maybe there's not engineering necessary. But if you have an understanding of how to do this and can do it safely, and the other part is, like, with the exception of getting hit while you're filling the pothole, it used to have nothing in it, right? Like, I mean, if they put marshmallows inside of it, it would probably be better than what it was. So it's hard to do damage when you're filling a pothole.
It's remarkable. And now, who will be the first to stop these guys? Because you imagine that? In New York City, I remember when New York City began to change me. And I was standing at a subway or someplace, and there was garbage blowing around everywhere. Now, I'm in some cities, I'm in towns and things, and I see garbage, I'll pick it up and I'll put it in the trash can. I don't do that in New York. You don't ever do that in New York for multiple reasons.
There's usually needles attached to each piece of garbage.
Yeah, so you don't do that in New York. But I remember seeing the trash blowing, and I remember thinking to myself about a year and a half into New York, when the hell is the city going to do something about this? And it just took me by surprise. I was like, what? And it was in front of our building. And I was complaining about the city. If here, go out and pick it up. Go out and sweep.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But you don't do that. And the city makes it impossible for you to want to do anything. They don't want you doing anything. No. Don't move that.
I mean, a lot of that is, you know, people justifying their jobs and people, yeah. You know. But there's a longer term ideological reason for these things, which is to imprison you to government. I mean, this is what they want you to believe. They like the idea that you're dependent on mm-hmm. them. It gives them the control. It gives them the power. It gives them everything. So when, and again, these are little examples of it, but it goes deeper than this. It's people who used to be, I need to go, oh my God, I lost my job. I got to need to get a job. Well, then there was people arguing for 99 weeks of unemployment, right? 99 weeks. That was never something like, look, there are reasons. There are reasons that mm-hmm. you know, these things pop up, but that it's a change in mindset in which we demand from the government things that we used to demand of ourselves.
It is remarkable that I think this is beginning to change. I really think this is beginning to change. Let me go to Andy in Washington, who has possibly an example. Hello, Andy.
Good morning, fellas.
You're in Washington State?
Yes, sir.
Where? What part?
Yakima Valley, Eastern Washington.
Okay. Eastern Washington. All right. Tell me what's going on.
Well, you had made a comment, one of you did, a bit ago about an Idaho school that does some concealed carry.
Mm-hmm.
We have at least 2 here just in the Yakima Valley that also do. And I know there's, well, at least a couple more that are talking about it.
And so people are starting, the teachers are starting to conceal carry?
Well, it's not so much teachers as it is admin and or conceal carry security guards. But in fact, while we're on the subject, it's an I-1620, I think. They're trying to get names to get it on the ballot for November to allow concealed carry for almost any staff, I believe, that passes the security and training.
So when you said Yakima, I responded, okay. Meaning, okay, I understand your phone call now, because I saw that you were talking, you wanted to talk about concealed carry teachers in Washington State. Washington State is a really good example of this. There are two states. I mean, it's not even the same state. You go Seattle and Yakima. It's a completely different world from one side of the state to the other. You do that in California. you drive, you know, 25 miles and it's a different state. The people think differently. So how do you think it's going to go over, Andy, you know, in the Seattle area?
You know, actually, the gentleman that started the initiative, the name gathering for the initiative 1621, he's actually from Bellevue, I believe.
Oh, my gosh.
Or in Bellevue somewhere, which really surprised me.
But, yeah.
You know, you're correct, though. The eastern and western Washington, the same with Oregon and or California.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like two complete states. Western, well, I mean, you're from Washington. Western Washington, it's two counties, has enough population to overrule the vote for the entire state.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I don't know how we bring this together other than I think there's a growing number of people, especially in these really divided areas and in states that are failing, that people are starting to say, okay, guys, I don't want to play teams anymore. What do we do to make this work? And common sense is starting to take a toehold, not a foothold, but a toehold in some of these very, very progressive states. Have you seen any of that, Andy?
A little, yeah, not a ton, but, you know, you look around Seattle and things are so crazy. You know, there comes a point where even somebody who's absolutely anti-gun has to realize that we have to do something, and what we've been doing for, you know, umpteen years isn't working.
Yeah. Andy, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Sort of feels like the momentum of all of this is going to help these situations. Like, there wasn't a way easily to do a map of all, you know, potholes, right? It would have been a pain for people to do that. But now with crowdsourcing and apps and all these things, I mean, like, you look at
change.
Waze is that company that does the traffic, you know, like your GPS mm-hmm. app. And it's like people are constantly reporting when everything from something's in the road or a car is pulled over on the side of the road. And you pull up and you're like, how long has this car been here? An hour? And there's 25 reports of this one car pulled over to the side of the road that doesn't even affect traffic flow at all. It's because people are constantly reporting. And as this stuff improves and people are involved in it, you think it's going to be easier. The momentum of the technology.
Well, you know how Google gets Google traffic, right?
Just monitoring people as they drive, right?
It's tracking your phone. So you've got your phone in your car, you're driving, it sees when you're slowing down, that goes and is fed up into the system, and it creates this map.
I'm old enough, Glenn, to remember when traffic cams were this big thing, and they were like, oh my God, you could check your traffic on your way to work. Because of traffic cams that the government put up mm-hmm. to see certain roads. Think of how ancient that is now.
Oh, I know.
I mean, that is just...
Well, the big signs that say that hang over, you know, hey, slow down, or this amount of time to, you know, the next exit. Well, I don't need that.
Right.
It's like, oh, really? Well, that's super. I'll watch that on my magic box at home before I leave every day.
Glenn Beck.
Hey, just a quick personal note. I'd ask for some prayers for Robert Morris. He's a friend of mine and a good man. He's from Gateway Church here and huge positive influence in the community. He was medevaced to the hospital yesterday for some complications after some surgery. And just keep Robert Morris in your prayers.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.